Hello and welcome to the Potential Psychology Podcast. I'm your host, Ellen Jackson, and it's my mission to share the science of human behaviour in a practical, fun and inspiring way. In each podcast episode, I interview an expert from the fields of psychology, well-being, leadership, parenting or high performance. I pick their brain to uncover what they know about living well, what tips do they have for you and I, and I quiz them about how they apply their expertise in their own life. Join me as we discover simple, science-backed ways to live, learn, flourish, and fulfill your potential. Hello and welcome to episode 52 of the Potential Psychology Podcast. It is very excellent to have you here. And I'm kicking off today with a little bit of insight into how we come up with the guests and topics that we cover on the podcast, and kind of behind the scenes, if you will. And I'd love to say that it's all very planned and strategic, but it's really not. So here we go. For this episode, several weeks ago, I was cruising through Twitter and came across an account called Quite Interesting. And their tweet on this day was this: if the 5 trillion spiders in the Netherlands took to eating humans rather than insects, they would consume all Dutch people in just 3 days. And my first thought on hearing this was, oh, wow, that is hilarious. And I'm imagining an enormous horde of 5 trillion spiders descending on the Netherlands, et cetera, et cetera. But then I wondered whether there are, in fact, 5 trillion spiders in the Netherlands, because that seems like a lot. And is it actually possible to know how many spiders there are in a country? And then who calculates this? And then I wonder how they'd calculate how long it would take all those spiders to eat the entire population of the Netherlands, and how they went about figuring that out. And is this even accurate? Or does somebody just make the whole thing up? And so maybe you might be getting a bit of an insight into how my brain works now. So the first path of choice for my brain is almost always the analytic, and then the curious. But then it occurred to me that for people with a serious fear of spiders, this particular tweet could actually be quite horrifying, and it could be quite harmful. And I'm sure absolutely no harm was meant, but there are some people for whom just visualising all of those spiders could actually be very problematic. So then I got curious about phobias, like an acute phobia of spiders. Why do we have them, and where do they come from, and what happens when they become so acute that we're triggered by a tweet? And then how do we treat a phobia like that? And when questions like that swirl through my head, I know I'm onto a podcast episode idea. So with the help of my amazing colleagues, I tracked down today's guest, who is an expert on fears and phobias and obsessive compulsive disorder, and all the things that relate to intrusive thoughts about what might happen, because they're kind of all interrelated, as we'll find out. So let's have a chat to her. With me today is Dr. Celine Gelgetch, a clinical psychologist based in Melbourne here in Australia, who specialises in anxiety and all of the different ways in which it manifests and challenges us. Celine is a senior clinical psychologist and the director of the Melbourne Wellbeing Clinic. She works with children, adolescents and adults who experience obsessive compulsive disorder and anxiety disorders, as well as secondary depression. And I've asked Celine to join us today to talk a little bit about phobias. But I suspect this conversation will divert into some of the other topics around anxiety, and particularly obsessive compulsive disorder, because I know that's one of your areas of specialty. So welcome, Celine.
Thank you so much. It's really exciting.
I'm excited to have you here. I do have lots and lots of questions for you, but I might even just start out by asking, what got you interested in OCD or obsessive compulsive disorder, firstly?
So many, many years ago, probably about over 10 years ago now, when I was a student, I was on my final placement at the Melbourne Clinic, which is a private psychiatric hospital in Richmond. And I was on placement there in the OCD inpatient unit. And while I was working there, I was there for about 6 months as a student. And then I was lucky enough to be offered a job. So I got to stay on, and I was there for another 3.5 years. And over that time, I just really fell in love with working with the condition in terms and the people as well, in terms of hearing their stories and being allowed into that journey, because people with OCD can be quite private because of the nature of their intrusive thoughts. It can be quite confronting and scary, and so they're not always ready and willing to disclose that because there's thoughts of, what if I'm crazy? No one's going to understand this. You know, what if I really am a pedophile or a murderer, or a, you know, what if I really do kill someone because I wasn't careful enough? Or what if I, you know, spread germs and people get hurt because of me? Or what if I stuff it up because I didn't do it right? You know, all those sorts of things. And there can be really confronting things to talk about with people. So it's easy to hide. It's easy to not disclose any of that. So I just felt very, privileged in being able to share those experiences with people and seeing the recovery and that journey, I guess, of people coming in distress but then working through and really understanding OCD and knowing that there's something they can do to help manage and eventually overcome what they're dealing with.
So can you tell us, because I think there's a lot of misunderstanding, and I was particularly interested to see, we always ask our guests for a list of resources and links and things that our audience might like to access after listening to an interview. Yeah. And I noticed that you included a link to a YouTube video that's called You Probably Don't Have OCD and This Is Why.
Yes.
Because there is a lot of misunderstanding about OCD. It is one of those terms that we often use just in kind of everyday parlance now to refer to someone who, you know, likes things to be neat and tidy or can be a little ritualistic about things. So what is it actually?
So OCD, for me, everyone has a little bit of obsessive compulsive, but what people don't have is the disorder in terms of the part that really impacts on life, the part that makes your world start to get smaller, the part that makes you start to feel scared about taking on challenges or taking risks or even talking to people or interacting with people starts to become nerve-wracking, and you become hyper-vigilant about your surroundings, and it starts to take up a lot of your thinking process. That's when it starts to become a problem, when it's really interfering in your life and stopping you from being the person you want to be, stopping you from doing the things you want to do, taking those challenges and risks. That's when we really need to start going, okay, this is no longer okay. It's getting in the way. It's a hurdle. I'm going to need some support.
Okay, so it is actually an anxiety disorder, is it not?
Well, it was.
Okay.
Anxiety is a part of it. The DSM, when it got upgraded in 2013 to the DSM-5, OCD came out of the anxiety disorders and was classified on its own. And so while anxiety is a large part of it, it's now got its own classification system under obsessive compulsive and related disorders. And then within that there's hoarding and loads of other things like trichotillomania and that sort of stuff. So I think what people have and the research is showing that it's, while anxiety is a really large component of OCD, there's so much more to it. And I think that's really helped inform treatment too. So the layers involved in treating OCD too is becoming much better understood, I think.
So we can all be a little obsessive compulsive, but we don't necessarily have obsessive compulsive disorder.
Yeah, we all have our little quirks.
Which brings me, I guess, to phobias, because I think certainly my understanding of phobias is that we do all have degrees of different phobias and sometimes they're very common things. I think most of us have a bit of a phobia about snakes and spiders, especially here in Australia where they tend to be, you know, fatal at times. But we'll have other specific fears that maybe we're kind of okay with or maybe can be very problematic for us. What is a phobia from a psychological point of view?
Yeah, so from a psychological point of view, a phobia is something that causes excessive distress in response to anything, really. People can have phobias about literally anything. I once worked with someone who had a phobia of balloons. But, I mean, you've got your common ones like you talked about in terms of snakes, spiders, various different animals, dogs, cats, bugs, that sort of thing. And then, yeah, you've got your more uncommon ones, like balloons, for example, or black dots.
Really? Black dots.
And so many other things. Like, the list is endless. And I guess the thing to think about again is, while you might not like something, if it's not impacting on your life, if you can live your life fairly functionally without being impacted, then do we technically call it a phobia, or do we call it something that, you know, just causes a reaction, but it's not persistent? So it's not just, is it distressing, but it's also the frequency and intensity and duration of that distress. So, for example, if you were working as a zookeeper, but you had a fear of monkeys, but you were fine with all the rest of it, then obviously that's going to impact on your functioning. So we would classify that as a phobia. But if you were scared of spiders and didn't really like them much, most of us live in houses, and how often do we come across spiders anyway? Can you chuck it in the garden? Can you spray it with Mortine? Can you do whatever? You know, it feels uncomfortable, but we can tolerate it to a certain extent. Mm-hmm. And we don't like it, and you don't have to like it, but it's, can you cope with it? Can you do what you need to do and then move on with your day? Okay. Or are you paralyzed and stuck to the point where it impacts on functioning? So I guess it kind of comes down to that.
So it could be then the degree of impact that it has on you, so the degree of emotional distress that you might have if exposed to that thing. So I know I don't particularly love spiders, you know, they crawl, and we have big ones here like huntsmen that run, which is a bit alarming, but I can tolerate them, that's fine. I'm very fortunate enough to have a 10-year-old son who takes quite delight in catching them and releasing them into the garden, so that's helpful.
Yeah.
But I remember having a friend stay with me at my parents' farm when we were young, and she actually couldn't go in and out the front door because there was a spider nearby. It wasn't like even close, it was nearby, and she actually just couldn't bring herself to walk past there. So that would obviously be a bit more disabling if it means you can't get in and out of your house.
Exactly. Absolutely. Yeah. They're perfect examples of the differences of something being more disabling versus don't like it, but I can tolerate it even though I don't like it. Yeah.
Okay. And why do we have them?
Why do we have them? We can have them for different reasons. Largely they're learnt. In terms of growing up, you might have someone in the household who's afraid of some of these things, so you learn that reaction and you internalize that fear. Or sometimes there's like massive traumatic experiences, or there's really unpleasant experiences that gets internalized and that fear kind of sticks. So we can have them for all sorts of different reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And are some of them more innate? Because I think, you know, when we look at things like snakes or spiders, again, particularly in Australia where they are quite dangerous or can be quite dangerous.
Yeah.
Flying, you know, fear of flying sort of makes some logical sense to me, because it doesn't really make sense that we should be up there in the air in a giant tin, giant metal thing.
Yeah.
Fear of heights kind of makes some sense because, you know, there is threat there.
Yeah.
But fear of balloons doesn't necessarily make sense, or fear of or black dots or glitter. I do know people for whom glitter is a problem. So are some of them just innate and they kind of make sense, and then others not?
I think from a perspective of, you know, some of the more stranger ones where there's no logical consequence of something, I could actually die, or, you know, I'm going to get harmed or something like that, like glitter, for example. I think it comes down to more of the feeling, like, for example, it doesn't feel right, or it might be a disgust factor, or it might be a textural thing rather than an emotional thing. And so there are all these different reasons that might not have a harm consequence, but have more of a either an emotional, a textural, or a some other thing that people then, the thought comes in, it kind of gets stuck, and then the interpretation of that starts to become bigger and bigger, and then the brain starts catastrophizing that even more. And then before you know it, you've talked yourself up into this really big anxiety-provoking situation, and that becomes more of a learned situation. So when we pair, I guess, the stimulus or the trigger with emotions, that's like a perfect recipe for our brain to really cement that into our long-term memory and be like, don't forget that, because that caused a lot of distress and we need to protect our person from that distress, and whatever's associated with that distress kind of goes with it. So it kind of becomes a harm-related thing, but it's misplaced, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the time people are like, I know logically this doesn't make sense, but I just can't. It feels too wrong.
And is that a little bit of what happens with OCD where people might have, because I do remember one, and I should see if I can look it up and find it. It was an amazing program that I watched years ago on TV, and it was about, I think it might have been an English program, and they put
The House of OCD?
Yeah, The House of OCD, that's it. They put a number of people together who all had OCD, but it manifested in different forms. So there was a guy who was really, who didn't like sharp objects, so, and he was a teacher, and so he developed this fear. And my understanding was his fear was that somewhere in his brain, or somewhere his brain was telling him that if he was near sharp objects, he could pick one up and stab someone.
Yeah.
And he didn't really believe he was going to, but that was the fear. So it's that kind of what the brain does.
Absolutely.
Perhaps with some harmless information, and then spins it off out of control.
Absolutely. Because what happens is, just by way of the way the brain functions, is the anxiety center of our brain, which is known as the amygdala, largely controls emotions. When that's active, I mean, it's always active, but when it's heightened, I guess, what it starts to do is it starts to shut down our frontal lobes from working, and our frontal lobes are responsible for higher order stuff. So like problem solving, reasoning, logic, attention, concentration, decision making, all the stuff we need, really. And that makes us different from the rest of the animal kingdom, in inverted commas. And so if our ability to reason and logic is shutting down, we're then functioning purely from the emotional center of our mind, and that problem solves, but from an emotional perspective rather than a logical perspective. And it will talk to our long-term memory and be like, quick, what did Celine do last time she was in this situation that made this go away? And it doesn't have to make logical sense. It's just whatever got rid of the distress. That's the answer. And so there's immediate relief. But then when everything calms down, the amygdala is like, okay, great, I've done the job, my person's safe, we're good. And then the frontal lobes come back online again, and then you think back and you go, what the hell is that about? Why am I doing that? Because logic's kicking back in. But so a lot of people often say, I know it doesn't make sense, but when I'm in the moment, I just can't help it. And so, you know, that then leads us to going, okay, well, a lot of what we're doing here is really learning to regulate some of this anxiety, learning to sit with some of this discomfort, learning to build tolerance to this level of discomfort in terms of treatment, rather than focusing on content of thoughts, if that makes sense.
Okay, so we're kind of being hijacked, I guess.
Yes.
By a brain at that point, shutting down that logical part that says, you don't actually have anything to fear here. Nothing's really bad is going to happen, but for whatever reason, because the level of anxiety is heightened, that bit shut down and we're kind of taken over. And is that where some of the behaviours that we often associate with OCD, for example, like excessive hand washing or having to double check things, is that what's coming in when you talk about, you know, what did Celine do last time? Well, she just washed her hands again.
Yep. And then you build tolerance to that, because the other thing that gets activated is the reward center, the reward pathways in our brain. So the message is we're doing the right thing, you know, and then it becomes almost like a drug addiction where you feel like you need to do more to get the same effect because you're developing that tolerance to it. And then after a while, the more we do it, people can get stuck there for hours because it just is never feels enough.
And so I'm kind of, my mind is going, you know, coming back to the phobia idea and almost beyond phobias, just some of the rituals and almost superstitions that we can have.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm imagining, you know, the footballers who have to put their socks on in a certain way, you know, one foot before the other, or some of those little rituals that we have. You know, I've been watching the French Open, and you watch Rafa Nadal and his, you know, kind of the hair flick and a couple of other things that we manifest these rituals because somewhere in there we think, I did this once and we won, or I did this once and I played a brilliant game. Somewhere do we kind of believe that if we keep doing it, we're going to keep having the same outcome? Is that what's going on there?
Yeah, in a sense, like we do. We have this magical thinking idea of, in a sense, innately sort of believing, I guess, becoming hopeful that this action led to this consequence. Therefore, if I do it again, it might happen again. And, you know, I'm guilty of that too. How many times have we knocked wood on something or done whatever else it might be. And I remember as a kid wearing my lucky socks, playing cricket in primary school and all that sort of stuff. The more meaningful things are to us, the more likely we are to engage in those behaviours. And I guess it's because it just tells us that we want it to go well. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, the scientist in me says, well, then I would have won the lottery 10 times over by now. And
So a lot of our behaviour can defy logic. Mm-hmm. Yes. And we do it for other reasons.
That's right. Yeah. And more emotional than logical.
Yeah, which is just reminded me, you talk about being a kid, and I remember I was living in Melbourne. Mm-hmm. This is going to betray my age, but I was living in Melbourne. I was about 10 when we had the big Ash Wednesday bushfires, and although I wasn't anywhere near the affected areas, we did have ash fall and we had glowing orange sky. It was quite scary. My parents were out at the time, yeah. And I remember being quite upset because I didn't know what was going on. We had a young babysitter and she didn't know what was going on. And I remember going to bed and I could see all this stuff. There was a little gap in the curtain. Mm-hmm. And I could see this orange sky. And I remember having to really close it tight so I couldn't see it because it was distressing me. Mm-hmm. For years, like literally almost decades in that house, I have had to do that same thing of having to close that. It took me a long time to be comfortable with not having that bit of curtain closed. And is that because of that level of emotion that was going on for me at the time?
Exactly. The higher the level of emotion at the time, the more the brain really struggles to let that go because it becomes survival then. And then we enter into that fight, flight or freeze where when we're in fight mode, we might overcompensate by doing some of these safety behaviours. When we're in flight mode, we might avoid. We don't want to think about it. We don't want to talk about it. We don't want to whatever. We might keep ourselves busy or something like that. Or if we freeze, we totally surrender and give in to the demands. And for someone with OCD, that looks like giving in to the demands of OCD and just doing what OCD wants them to do. For someone with phobias, it's following through with all the checks and balances they might need to do, you know, all that sort of stuff. And then the brain doesn't want to forget that because it's like, no, I can't risk my person being hurt. You know, I need to look after that really primal response takes precedence over anything else.
And I love that way, that language you're using about my person, because it does really kind of help you to see how your brain and the person running the brain don't always sync up, if you know what I mean. Like the brain's there to protect the person.
That's right. Yeah. And they're not always on the same page. And your certain parts of your brain might not always do what you want it to do. But there is that part of us that has that reflective capacity to, you know, when things come back online and threat has passed, we are able to reflect and recognize and develop insight and grow and learn how our brain works and thinks. And that's when change occurs.
Yeah. Yeah. And my understanding is that anxiety-related issues, just understanding that can make a big difference to helping people overcome it. Is that right?
Absolutely. Because the thing is, we can't get rid of it. We can't all just cut our amygdala out because, you know,
we probably need it.
Yeah. It's there for a reason. Like it stops us from driving too far or it stops us from taking too many other risks or, you know, it stops us from going, oh, I wonder what will happen if I open the plane door while the plane's in the air.
So things toddlers might do.
Yeah, things toddlers might do, absolutely. Yeah.
So, Celine, when it comes to coming back to phobias in particular, when it comes to treatment, so say, because I know there are people for whom some of these phobias become quite problematic. I know parents who have children who have a real fear of dogs, for example. You know, that's hard. If you go for a walk down the street and you're confronted with a dog, that is going to be distressing for everybody. So what are some of the kind of methods we use to help treat these challenges? Yeah.
The most common method that's used is called exposure therapy. In a sense, it's a form of desensitization. So you'll get to know the person, get to know what exactly about dogs, for argument's sake, is triggering, because it could be different for everybody. And then you work out and you brainstorm with the person different ways of kind of gently exposing the person to each of those things. So for argument's sake, it might be the sound of a bark, might be uncomfortable but not too bad. So that'll kind of be the way to kind of step into that. Then we might have a look at cartoon pictures of dogs, then real pictures of dogs, like photographs of dogs, And then we might go for a walk down the street and be across the road from a dog or something like that, and eventually gradually slowly working up to holding a leash, touching one, patting one, letting one smell your hand, you know, that sort of stuff. So it's a way of just gently wading in. At our clinic, we're lucky enough to have virtual reality as a tool to phobias, which is really cool. And dogs are on there, which is great, as well as a whole myriad of other things. And the great thing about virtual reality is it's a really nice bridging gap between doing some of the in-house stuff or using imagination as a form of exposure as well as pictures and other things. Like you might bring in a dog leash or something, you know, that sort of stuff, and actually going out and doing exposure work in real time. So it's a really nice bridging gap and it's still safe. So I know the one with the dog, for example, like, again, there's cartoony versions and then there's more real life, realistic looking versions. And so, you know, you can mirror and mimic those things of walking across the street from a dog, one with a muzzle, one without a muzzle, one with a leash, one without a leash. So the different degree of difficulty comes into it too.
Not that easy always to organise that without the use of technology, having these dogs in it. And for other things, I'm imagining things like, well, spiders, if spiders are becoming a real problem, fear of flying. I know that that is one that they've traditionally used. I suppose they've actually had to have simulators and different things, but virtual reality gives you that in a much simpler, easier, more accessible way that you can actually do inside your clinic.
Yeah, absolutely. Because, I mean, there are lots of flight schools and things, which is really great. But then, you know, they can also be really costly. So not everyone's always going to have access to that stuff. And not everyone is always going to be going on a holiday regularly enough to have that desensitization happen, because the most important thing is consistency and repetition in terms of treatment. So, you know, doing exposure once isn't going to really achieve much. And I think the best way of really relating to that is expecting to build your fitness. If you're trying to, you know, increase your fitness, you can't just walk once and expect to be fine. You need to keep doing a little bit each day or a little bit every other day to really build on that. And the brain works the same way. If we want the brain to change, we need to treat it like a muscle and we need to exercise it. So absolutely, it gives people more of that flexibility.
Wonderful. And so is the idea, as we kind of gently expose people or expose ourselves, because I'm guessing this is the kind of thing that, you know, if we've just got a mild issue with spiders or bugs or something, you know, that gradual exposure is just to get comfortable with that discomfort.
Yes, absolutely. You don't have to like it. You just have to be comfortably uncomfortable with it.
Okay. Sit with it, as we say.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Fantastic. Do you know, I mean, here's just some interesting things about phobias, because I know this is the kind of stuff that just fascinates people. I know it fascinates me. Do we know or have any idea about the number of people or percentage of people who might have significant phobias, things that become really problematic?
Yeah, well, I think, like, if we think about the stats for anxiety just generally, I think it's about 1 in 4 people at any one time has a diagnosed anxiety disorder, and like phobias would fit into that. So if you think about it from that perspective, it's pretty full on. A lot of the stats that are out there are American statistics, but in terms of the 1 in 4, that also relates to Australian stats. So there's quite a number of people.
Yeah, absolutely. And we've spoken a bit about some of the more common ones, and you mentioned some of the ones that you've come across that are less common, like balloons, but are there any other kind of unusual? Could people literally be scared of anything?
Pretty much, yeah. Anything that's caused, like, for example, if there was a tissue box on your desk and you heard an explosion go off while grabbing a tissue, your mind could associate that loud noise and that fear with the tissue. So all of a sudden you might start feeling a little bit anxious when going near tissue boxes, for argument's sake. Like, I think if there's a strong enough emotional reaction, it could literally be anything.
Okay. Which, when you think about it that way, it does make sense, you know, that a balloon, for example, you know, if someone's, especially because if balloons pop in your face, that's quite a startling thing.
Absolutely. Especially if you're a toddler and then all of a sudden, like, it just bursts in your face, that's something that could provoke a strong enough emotional reaction to then stick with you.
Mm. And then I'm guessing that the more you avoid those things then, if that's your response, is to avoid being exposed to it because it makes you uncomfortable or fearful, the more you do that and the longer you do that for, kind of in your mind, the bigger the fear becomes.
100%.
And so thinking about it in that context, it does sort of make sense that people could develop kind of, you know, a fear about anything.
Absolutely. And the thing, I guess, in terms of that, of developing that fear, often we think what we need to do is to avoid and all that sort of stuff. But while that gives us immediate relief, it just makes it worse in the long run, as you mentioned. You know, the very thing we fear doing is the thing that we need to do gradually in order to overcome it. Yeah.
And so that's the approach and the goal of treatment then is just to kind of have that gradual exposure.
Yeah. And some people, you know, will choose the flooding approach of just kind of going right to the top. But I always find there's a lot of prep work too that needs to go into that to prepare the person in terms of building a toolbox to help cope with the level of distress.
So if that spider's, for example, it's just basically thrusting a big spider at someone and saying, hold it.
Pretty much, which can be quite distressing. But, you know, that's effective too. I guess it's just a matter of figuring out what you feel comfortable with and as long as you're working with someone to help support you through that process, I think.
Although I must admit, inadvertently, that has helped for me because I always had a bit of a thing about spiders. I think, as you say, it's interesting that you say about what's modelled for you because my mum has always been a bit with spiders, so it was kind of, I suspect, a bit of a learned thing. And then I did have a couple, I've had two instances, and please tune out for anybody who does have a particular fear of spiders. I've had two instances in which I've had huntsmen land on me. So one was actually in the shower. It was up on the ceiling and I thought, you're right, you stay there. If you stay there, I'm okay with you. But the steam from the shower must have made it. It fell on me. I realised what happened. I squealed and flicked it across the room, managed to get rid of it. But to be honest, after that, I was kind of like, you know what? A spider landed on me and I lived. So maybe it doesn't matter so much anymore. And then a second one was actually not realising at the time, but I was out, I don't know where I'd collected it from, but I was hanging washing in the garden and I suddenly felt something and I looked and here's this huntsman on my shoulder and again flicked it away. But probably I don't think I had as an extreme response that time. I just got rid of it. Now I'm still not going to pick them up like my son does, but, you know, I think for me it was kind of like being able to then say to myself, spider walked on me and I'm still okay. It's not that bad.
Definitely. I have a similar experience where I had a learned fear of cats and dogs because my mum, she got bitten when she was 5 by a dog. So she then learned to fear dogs. And then I learned that fear through her. But then as an adult, having a cat of my own, because I always loved animals and thought they were, you know, I still do obviously, I think they're adorable. And I was like, this cat is up for adoption. It's really cute. I'm scared, but at the same time, I really want to try and overcome this fear. So bringing it home as a young kitten, you know, now we're in each other's faces and have cuddles and all the rest of it, and there's no fear. And I guess over the first, I would say probably 3 or 4 months of getting used to it really kind of helped abate my anxiety to get used to it, which is really cool.
So we can actually, with milder phobias or fears, activate our own exposure therapy just, you know, consciously or unconsciously, inadvertently in my case.
Definitely.
Wonderful. And I was going to come back to just a question about OCD and the treatment for OCD. So, I mean, obviously there's a bit of overlap here with the kind of fears and behaviours and what have you. More broadly, what are the approaches to treating obsessive compulsive disorder?
Yeah, so it's similar in a sense where the treatment is exposure and response prevention. So the exposure happens to triggers, intrusive thoughts, and the worry beliefs that are around the intrusive thoughts. So we purposely bring them up gradually. We work out a bit of a hierarchy, least anxiety provoking to most anxiety provoking. And then what happens is that then obviously generates discomfort. And the person feels uncomfortable, whether it's guilt, uncertainty, anxiety, disgust, frustration, anger, whatever it might be. That then brings up distress, and then there's a really strong urge to engage in a associated compulsion to alleviate that distress. But what we do is we teach tools to help sit with that discomfort so that the person then can surf that urge and ride that wave and not do the compulsion, which then gradually through lots of repetition, and I mean lots of repetition, the pathways of the brain slowly start to change in a sense where a path would recently be activated going, no, this is what I need to do to alleviate this distress. The brain's then like, I've now unlearned that response, if that makes sense.
Yeah, okay. I can understand OCD when it comes to, say, some of those obsessive behaviours, so having some intrusive thoughts and then wanting to wash your hands or check things. Mm-hmm. What about some of the other intrusive thoughts or beliefs that people have? You know, I've certainly heard, I know Osher Ginsberg talks about struggling with OCD and a lot of his intrusive thoughts, which ended up manifesting as almost psychotic type, you know, hallucinations and things, were around fears like climate change.
Yeah. Some of the bigger life questions.
Yeah. Yeah. So what's kind of going on there?
There are lots, but underlying that is a sense of responsibility. Underlying that is what we call scrupulosity type OCD, where people are really fused with needing to be a good person, wanting to be responsible, wanting to do the right thing, which are wonderful qualities to have as a person. But what people feel distressed about is, while it's important to worry about these things, I'm one person in the bigger world, and this is what becomes overwhelming, and I can't fix it on my own. We need other people to also be involved with this, and the distress in needing to get messages out there and doing this and, you know, all this other stuff, it just becomes really distressing. And people start to also feel depressed about that because it's like, well, what can I do? How significant am I in this world? Which can then lead to existential type OCD, where people then worry about and have this preoccupation with, what's my purpose in life? What are we doing here? And, you know, can search the internet incessantly and spend hours and hours and hours needing to find the answer, when perhaps really, is there an answer to any of this stuff? You know, we're still trying to think about all of this. So that's where people get stuck. And while part of it is consistent with values, there's also a part that causes distress because it's like, okay, be involved in these causes, do all this amazing stuff. But then at the same time, we need to be comfortably uncomfortable with the fact that it's not going to be fixed overnight. You know, we all have a role to play. And, you know, excuse my French, some people are a shit. Some people do not realize that this is a problem and are completely ignorant to it, you know, all that sort of stuff.
But we can't control what other people do.
We can't control what other people do, absolutely not.
Okay, so this is a specific type, some of this, so there's more than just one type of OCD, I guess, is what I'm asking.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there's, you know, it comes under that idea of scrupulosity in terms of the morality, existential, there's thoughts about pedophilia, there's thoughts about people get sexual intrusive thoughts, there is germs and contamination, obviously there's order and symmetry, there's saving and loss, people get aggressive intrusive thoughts, people have thoughts of what if I lose control, so there's suicidal as well in terms of, for example, what if I lose control and kill myself, in terms of people often say, I don't want to do this, but I'm worried that I might, you know, what if it happens, there's relationship type intrusive thoughts as well where people worry about, am I attracted to my partner, you know, or they might get jealous if their partner is talking to somebody else, that they might think, you know, what's going on there? Do I love my partner? Yeah, all that sort of stuff.
So the obsessive compulsive part comes in where these thoughts and feelings, I'm guessing, sort of become so overwhelming. So perhaps, you know, when it comes to things like climate change, I'm so overwhelmed by what there is to do and how we're going to do it. And they become obsessive, intrusive.
That's right.
Thoughts, and they're compulsive, and then perhaps so there's associated behaviours that become compulsive.
That's right. Like, I need to solve it, or I need to find the answer, or I need to be involved in every single thing possible, or I need to get my message out there, you know, all that sort of stuff.
Okay, so sort of a fear and overwhelm, and it's sort of just, it's spiralling out of your control.
Yeah, and in terms of what you mentioned earlier of kind of verging on that delusional, almost psychotic kind of presentation is for me, that's when anxiety gets so high, when people's anxiety levels kind of are through the roof. You know, the brain kind of then generates this idea of this is what's going on, and people, the person then starts to believe that that actually might be true, which then causes an even bigger level of distress.
And that, yeah. So Osher Ginsberg, in his book, which is back after the break, and he talks about, you know, actually seeing sea levels rising. You know, it was like he could actually see, and so his brain and his body therefore were believing that that was what was occurring, and yet all the other signals around him, you know, nobody else seemed to be reacting to the fact that the sea levels were rising. They, and obviously left him and his brain in a complete quandary. And I think he does talk about the fact that that was the point at which he realized that he needed to do something.
And that's what happens when we get so stuck on an idea that the brain then starts to generate these intrusive images, that if it happens often enough, we then start to feel like it's true and that we believe it. And it's really just to keep pulling us back in and hooking us into that level of discomfort to reinforce that pattern.
Okay. So it's so interesting that obsessive compulsive disorder is so much broader, I suppose, than what most of us believe it to be. And I know, you know, we referred earlier to this YouTube video that I will encourage people to take a look at, because my understanding is that we're sort of kind of not helping people when we talk about having OCD in a sort of flippant way. Do you want to talk about that just briefly?
Yeah, like it's definitely used as an adjective probably more often than not, I guess. And, yeah, if you talk to anyone with clinical like levels of OCD, they'll often say, you know, they feel so frustrated. If only people knew what it was like. You know, it's not something that you wish you had. And it's really not. It's exhausting. It's tiring. It's, you know, 14% of people with OCD, which is a high statistic, can't work, you know. And the World Health Organization listed it in the top 10 of all the world's physical and mental conditions as the most debilitating condition. So, like, it's, people don't realize it, but the way that it can really take someone's life away in terms of what they want to be, who they want to be as a person, and the way it can also impact families and relationships, and the amount of relationships that become destroyed because of it, it's horrific. Yeah.
And so part of that, I'm guessing from the sounds of, you know, what you're saying, that your clients mentioned to you is that it would help them, it might help us all if we had a bit of a better understanding of what the disorder is and just how disabling it is, and perhaps not use those terms quite so flippantly, because it doesn't help. You know, it doesn't help us educate us as a community.
Yeah.
And I must admit, I've become a bit more sensitive, and I know it was firstly with the term schizophrenia or schizophrenic, you know, that used to be referred and sometimes still is as this kind of one thing or the other, or people could behave, you know, in different ways, and people would refer to that as being schizophrenic. And it was like, firstly, well, that's not an accurate representation of what schizophrenia is, but also that's not helping, because this is actually a really distressing disorder for people.
Absolutely. And even bipolar, like to describe two personalities, and it's like, actually, no, that's a totally different thing.
So the same with OCD, you know, if you find yourself wanting to use the phrase, just pause for a minute and think, actually, maybe I find a different way to describe this, because this could actually be quite distressing to somebody who either struggles with the disorder themselves or, you know, has a loved one or somebody they know who struggles with the disorder. So I will put a link to that video too, so that people can watch that as well. I will also put a link, Celine, to, you gave us such a wonderful long list of books and resources. I'm not going to go through them now because there's about 20 of them.
Yes.
But they're all there in the show notes for the episode, so that you can, if you're interested in following up. And that covers specifically around OCD. So you had a number of different books and tips and resources for people, but also anxiety generally.
Yeah.
Which is fantastic. So lots of information there. Is there one standout for you in terms of, you know, if there's kind of the first book you might go to?
Not particularly, because I err on the side of everyone's different. Everyone receives information differently. So I think you've got to just check out what's there and choose what feels right for you, because that's the most important thing and that's what's going to work.
Perfect psychologist response.
Yes.
Celine, thank you so much for today. It's been really interesting. I've learned a lot, and I hope our listeners have learned something too, or given us even just pause to think about our own fears and phobias and our anxiety responses to very ordinary things, and when they're helpful or when they're perhaps not helpful, and a better understanding of what's going on in our brains when we're having those experiences, just so that, you know, I think the more we can understand about what's happening, the more power we get.
Absolutely.
So I really appreciate all of your insights and wisdom and knowledge.
An absolute pleasure.
Where can people find you? I will put all the links in the show notes as well, but where can people find you if they want to find out more? Because I know you're on social media and you've got websites and all of that stuff.
Yeah. So people can find us on my practice's website, which is melbournewellbeinggroup.com.au. They can find me on Instagram. They can follow the clinic under Melbourne Wellbeing Group, or they can follow Dr. Celine Gelgetch as well. And it's the same handles for Facebook.
Okay. And you do have, you've got free resources on your website. You've also got blog posts.
Yes.
On your website.
Yeah. We have downloadable tip sheets and resources and that sort of stuff. And we do, we have a list of resources. We also have a weekly blog, which goes up. We also have a YouTube channel, which we were doing really good at posting videos, like little videos, but we haven't posted one up for a little while. But the aim is to get back onto that as soon as we can.
Maybe this will help trigger that.
Yes.
Get you back on. I know what it's like to put a lot of pressure on yourself to produce a lot of content.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah. I know that experience.
Yeah.
Celine, thanks again. I really do appreciate it. And I'd encourage everybody listening, if you've got an interest, to check out Celine's social channels, any of those resources on our episode and show notes page, and contact Celine yourself if you might like to know more.
Thanks so much, Ellen.
You have been listening to me talk to Dr. Celine Gelgetch. And as I mentioned, Celine has provided us with an enormous compilation of great resources if you're interested in learning more about OCD in particular, or anxiety and fears generally. And everything is in the show notes for this episode at potential.com.au/podcast. There you'll also find a full transcript for the episode. There's something in particular that you'd like to follow up or you like to read as well as listen. And there's more about Celine, links to her website, her social accounts, and her YouTube videos. Now, if you are keen to keep in touch with the podcast and the other great guests that we have coming up in season 6, as well as a couple of special events that I'll tell you about in a moment, you can get hold of all of that, plus our favourite positive psychology and self-development resources, via our mailing list. You can join through the links on the Potential Psychology website, potential.com.au, and you'll also find links to subscribe on our most social media channels. Just search for Potential Psychology on whatever platform you prefer. Next week, I'm sharing an adventure with you. If you follow Potential Psychology on social media, you might have seen me out and about with my portable recorder and my matching potential red shirt and red headphones at the International Positive Psychology Association's World Congress event that took place in Melbourne in mid-July. And over this four-day event, the world's positive psychology, happiness and well-being experts descended on Melbourne, put their collective heads together and shared the most mind-blowing quantity of research and knowledge. It really was way too much for one brain to take in. And there are also some fun events and marches and well-being adventures, and I've captured as much as I can to share with you here on the podcast. So next week, join me as we explore the International Positive Psychology Association's 6th World Congress right here in Australia. That is episode 53 of the Potential Psychology podcast. Thank you again so much for listening today. Thank you too to those wonderful people who have recently left reviews for the podcast on Apple iTunes. I often ask people if they wouldn't mind popping over and
providing a review on the podcast. We've had some wonderful feedback. I really, really appreciate it. I do read all of the reviews and get very excited. And you may see that I do share them occasionally on social media as well, because it's just so good to get that kind of positive feedback. It's very motivating for us here. And it's just a joy to know that the conversations that I have with our experts that I love and get so much from, you also love and benefit from. So if you haven't left a review and you'd like to, you can do so in iTunes via whichever platform you use, but you can certainly do it in the podcast's app if that's the one that you use. In fact, any feedback that you give us is very much appreciated. Also, please share the podcast with others who you feel might like to thrive and flourish. Until next week, have a fabulous week, and I'll see you then.